Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc webinar called No One Can Own the Law, the Third Circuit's Review of Whether Publishing ASTM Standards is Fair Use. We're very pleased to welcome a terrific panel of legal experts today. Professor Emily Brummer is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame Law School. Professor Brummer teaches and writes in the areas of administrative law, civil procedure, and business associations. Her scholarship focuses primarily on matters of procedural design and issues that arise at the intersection of public law and private ordering, with particular focus on the use of privately developed technical standards and governmental regulation. Professor V. Rosen is Associate Professor at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law and the Faculty Director of the Franklin Pierce Society for Intellectual Property. He has written extensively on the development of modern copyright and trademark law. He previously served as a scholar in residence at the U.S. Copyright Office. Our moderator, the Honorable Stephen Baden, was appointed as the Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture on July 7, 2025. Alongside Secretary Brooke Rollins, Deputy Secretary Baden leads the department's operations and implements policies that support America's food and farm systems. Previously, he served as judge on the U.S. Court of International Trade and general counsel of USDA, where he led successful Supreme Court litigation, advanced regulatory reform, and supported the implementation of the 2018 Farm Bill. If you would like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I will note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Judge Faden, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you so much, Sarah, and thank you to Professors Brummer and Rosen for joining us this afternoon for what I think will be a very interesting discussion. We're going to be talking about an issue that combines first principles, due process, and philosophical questions about what role the law plays, as well as transparency. We all know that we're responsible to follow the law, and even though it's probably impossible, the legal system rests on the foundation that we all have a responsibility to know all the laws that affect what we do every day. But increasingly, we see legislatures at both the state and federal level and agencies at both the state and federal level in their regulatory responsibilities, adopting private codes as part of the laws that govern us all. And some of those private codes, which are incorporated by reference into the law or regulation, are not easily public available. They are frequently behind a paywall that you may have to subscribe or become a member of a particular organization to have access to. Does that pose a problem? And seeing that potential problem, we have private sector and nonprofit counterparts that have decided to try to make this private standard, and in some ways, this private law that has been incorporated by reference, more transparent, perhaps tripping over some intellectual property rights that those private standard-setting societies may have. The collision of all these questions has come together in the case of American Society for Testing and Materials versus UPCodes Incorporated, and how the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania resolved these collisions of laws and values is currently on review before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. We have two wonderful experts in both IP and the area of incorporation by reference with us today. And we'll begin by getting some background on what led us to this collision in Pennsylvania federal court from Professor Emily Bremer. Professor?
Thank you so much, Judge. So that was a wonderful setup to what is a very complicated issue. And I'm going to do something probably annoying, and I'm going to make it even more complex, because I think there's yet another dimension that maybe is not well viewed by the courts, but is something that I have looked at in a lot of detail when I was working in the federal government at the Administrative Conference of the United States. About 10 or 15 years ago, we started looking at this question of issues that arise when federal regulatory agencies incorporate by reference copyrighted privately developed codes and standards. And I should say, I come at this from the perspective of an administrative lawyer. I care about transparency, democratic accountability. I also care about the private sector and about making sure that regulations make sense and work well, and that participation in the development of those norms is something that is broadly available. The challenge, I think, in the U.S. is that we have something that is ubiquitous, that every single person, nearly every moment of their life, interacts with, but that is invisible to almost everyone, which is an enormous private standardization system, right? So beginning around the turn of the 20th century, a lot of nonprofit organizations arose to collaborate and bring experts together in the private sector to come up with technical specifications that are necessary for a broad range of activities. They promote safety. They ensure that parts produced by different manufacturers are interoperable. They make our economic system work, and they also protect the public. And these are technical specifications. They sound to a lawyer like laws or like regulations, but they're not. They're put together typically by engineers, people who, as I like to say, have actual knowledge instead of just being able to talk pretty. And they really address absolutely everything. Now, we have that creates a challenge, and that challenge is that when agencies are regulating, they're often regulating in an area where there is a significant amount of private ordering, private standards that are already being used within the industry. And so there arise a variety of reasons, actually, why government wants to integrate those standards into regulations. Sometimes it's because Congress has taken a look at the problem, or the agency has taken a look at the area and has said, there's a standard, it's really good, it promotes public safety, but not everyone's complying with it. And the point of making it law is to put the force of law behind it to make sure that everyone complies. Sometimes the purpose is a little more nuanced than that, and it's more about providing technical details within regulations that are established by the government, or communicating to the industry how regulations and private standards integrate, which is really important because those industries are often going to be complying with those standards or conforming to those standards for reasons that have nothing to do with regulation. Now, about 20, 30 years ago, it became much more obvious that the consequence of incorporating by reference a privately developed standard is that you have to pay someone to look at the law, right? As government rulemaking documents and regulations and everything else became sort of ubiquitously available online, there's a holdout, and that's that class of documents that are copyrighted. And so, I come at this from an administrative law perspective, and I was interested in this problem in part because it seems crazy that you should have to pay to read the law as a pure matter of principle. Now, the question, though, becomes, how do you get to the goal of free access? The cases we're going to be talking about today sort of take a copyright approach to kind of breaking open that box. The solution that have offered and that has been recommended by the Administrative Conference of the United States and adopted by the Office of Management and Budget and implemented by both agencies and standards developers is more in keeping with the public-private partnership and standards and encouraging SDOs to provide free access, which has been actually pretty successful. Although I fear, and we'll get into this when we start, I think talking about the, and when we get into the Q&A, I fear that that is in danger in part because of the current copyright litigation. But I'm going to turn it over to Professor Rosen, who can address those issues.
Thank you. So this is such a fascinating case. And I'll be honest, usually when I come to a case, I have a pretty clearly defined opinion. And while I have definite opinions about some parts of the litigation, I don't think it's an easy case. So I'm going to take us back and try to condense a lot of history and development. This all starts in 1834, when two of the current and previous reported decisions for the U.S. Supreme Court had a lawsuit over whether or not the Supreme Court's decisions were copyright, were subject to copyright. The Supreme Court held that those decisions were not copyrightable, and Peters won. So that established this basic doctrine, the government's edicts doctrine, into precedent. Now, about 50 years later, you have two decisions, Banks versus Manchester and Callahan versus Myers. Banks was coming from Ohio, where the judges wrote the opinions of the state Supreme Court, and we also a syllabus and some headnotes. Those were held uncopyrightable under similar grounds as Wheaton. Callahan versus Myers, where a reporter who was not part of the government wrote the syllabus and headnotes, that was held, then those non-government written syllabus and headnotes were held to be copyrightable and protected. Now, that doesn't resolve the question of government edicts here because here we're dealing with privately written things that have been given some force of law, but it does set sort of the framework for this. Over all this time, the doctrine of fair use is also developing. You see Folsom versus Marsh, 1841. It's the first time that it's written out. And the modern fair use doctrine, which is part of the 76 Act, is in largely a codification of Folsom versus Marsh 130 years later. Folsom versus Marsh says you look at the purpose, the current act says, and Folsom essentially says, you look at the purpose and character of the use, the nature of a copyrighted work, the amount of substantiality that's taken by the infringer, and the effect on the market. Now, there was some debate when the statute was being drafted as, among other things, whether there should be an educational exception for fair use. Education be written into fair use as generally an exception that was not included, and also whether or not to have factors. Now, it's been argued that one approach instead would be to look at whether or not it would transform the work, and it's something that Judge Pierre Laval argued for. And in the early 1990s, in a case involving most incongruously a rap parody of a song Pretty Woman by Two Live Crew, whether or not that's a fair use. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's a parody because it transforms the song Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison with new meaning or message, and that it is necessary to take the entire song in order for the commentary that Two Live Crew had on Roy Orbison's song to be perceived properly. So that would flip the inquiry on its head and say, no, they had to take the whole thing to make their commentary. Now, there's also one other doctrine that's lurking here, which is the merger doctrine copyright, which says where the expression and uncopyrightable part are inextricably intertwined, the expression is also uncopyrightable. And certainly the amicus brief, you saw some urging to merger doctrine to be applied here as well. All that takes us to 2020 or so. Georgia versus Public Resource. Publicresource.org has been copying the Georgia Code annotated. The Georgia Code annotated has official annotations. And a splintered Supreme Court held that those official annotations are not copyrightable under the government edicts doctrine. And Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the majority, said the government edicts doctrine looks to the speaker. This is over a spirited dissent from Justice Thomas, who says, no, what's relevant for government edicts is what the law says. But that was in dissent. There was also a separate dissent from Justice Ginsburg, who said that this is the correct rationale, but it is but these annotations are copyrightable. But either way, those are both dissents. While this is going on, ASTM, which is also, of course, the litigant here, was suing publicresource.org. A decision of a D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals held that it was a fair use. Now, what's notable about for Public Resource to copy some of the ASTM codes. Now, this came just after two decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court. One of them was Google versus Oracle, in which the U.S. Supreme Court held it was a fair use for Google to copy the class names of a Java programming language to have a competing version to have Java on their Android phones, and they didn't have to pay royalties to Oracle, the owner of a Java copyrights. The reason for this is that the Java programming language is of a nature, in particular the minimally creative type and programming language, and the creation of new programs is something that copyright law wants to encourage. Shortly after that, a year or two later, in Warhol versus Goldsmith, the Supreme Court held that Andy Warhol's version of a photo of Prince taken by Lynn Goldsmith, at least insofar as it was licensed to a magazine for a cover, was not a fair use. The court said Goldsmith was in the market of selling her photos for magazines and, in fact, had actively done so recently. A different photo of Prince, actually the same photo of Prince. And the language about transforming the original with new meaning or message in the case about Pretty Woman should be read carefully, and it shouldn't. And the language "transform the original of new meaning or message" was not a pull quote you could then interpret freely, but you had to read the Campbell decision very much in the context of its language. It talks about taking no more than is needed, not being a market substitute. All that leads us to here. Now, the Google versus, because the Georgia versus Public Resource case said specifically, you look at the speaker. That tends to remove the government edicts doctrine from contention. It's why numerous cases involving upcodes have not really focused on government edicts doctrine. However, the briefs do argue that that Georgia versus Public Resource is either directly on point or indirectly, or perhaps some of the language from that case. And I will say, whether some of what Chief Justice Roberts says later about the animating goal of the government edicts doctrine probably does help upcodes more than the holding of a case. And whether it's dicta or part of a holding is, I'm sure, part of what's going to be debated. We still have a lot, but there's a lot of discussion of fair use. And I mean, frankly, it's an interesting question whether fair use is really. Fair use has really become very load-bearing in this day and age. And whether this is transforming the original of new meaning or message because you're making it available on the internet as opposed to making it available to subscribers, I don't know about that. But I look forward to talking about that more.
Professor Brimmer, do you have any reaction to these thoughts?
No, I think we can dive into whatever questions you'd like us to discuss.
Well, you know, as part of the fair use doctrine, there's one of those wonderful multi-factor balancing tests that courts look at with a host of different factors. And there seemed to be an important role for monetary reward in the fair use balance that was played out here. In other words, is upcodes receiving any type of relevant monetary reward for its posting of the American Society for Testing and Materials standards that were adopted in this case by the city of Philadelphia? And then on the other side of the equation was the question, well, if we allow this posting of these standards by upcodes, does the American Society for Testing and Materials, which loses its exclusivity over the publication and access to those standards, does it still have the requisite incentive to, my word, innovate? In other words, to keep coming up with better building standards, or by allowing UPCodes to publish this information and bypass the exclusivity that the society had previously, does it take away the incentive for the society to keep doing its job and keep giving us better building suggestions for professionals? And I'm just curious about, the court went through its analysis, of course, and it determined that it did not believe that UPCodes was gaining monetarily from its publication. Its rationale was that all you had to do in order to see UPCodes' publication of these standards was sign up for a free account, basically give them your email address and perhaps a password, and you could, without spending any money, access these. And then it's believed, and I was a little unclear as to why it believed this way. It seemed to me that this may have been, in my point of view, the weakest part of the opinion, but maybe you and Svi think differently. The court made the assertion that it believed that there was still the appropriate incentive for the American Society of Testing Materials to keep innovating, to keep coming up with new standards. And it pointed to the fact that it had indeed, during the pendency of this litigation, come out with new standards for some of the ones that the American Society of Testing Materials had published. So I'd be curious about what you two think about the court's analysis of the profit motive or the incentive motive on both sides of the equation, and whether you think it got that correct.
So can I give you a couple of reactions to that? So one thing I would point out is that the platform, and I was just tooling around to see what you can see without giving them your email address. It is free. You do have to give them your name and your email address and your industry. The phone number is optional. But it says sign up for a free 2-week trial, but you know what they also say, which is when it's free, you are the product. So I always worry about, you know, giving my information just to be able to view something. But I'll say on the UPCode side, you know, they're publishing the codes that are like the Code of Philadelphia, but that's actually a code that is, it starts off as a model code that's created by the International Code Council, which has also been suing UPCodes in other litigation because the model code is also copyrighted. So they've got the codes and the standards, all of which the producers of them claim a copyright. And I guess the trouble I had with the court's analysis on that side of it is that if you take away the codes and the standards, it seems to me that no one would pay for anything UPCodes is offering. The entire platform is a platform to access and review and get AI help with, and an integrated platform of all the codes and standards. So it seems to me that's an absolutely but-for integral ingredient into the business model. And in the absence of that, like, no one's going to pay for a service that gives you AI help to search a document that's not there. Right. And so I found that really, really difficult. And I did wonder if they ever asked, you know, for a license, because actually I could see why standards developers might actually benefit quite a lot from having, a sophisticated company like UPCodes putting all their stuff together in an integrated platform with the products of other companies. But what little I was able to see suggested that there were never any licensing negotiations. Maybe that's wrong. I would be very interested to hear otherwise. On the ASTM side, I think the challenge is the court kind of treats it as a matter purely of like motivation. Right. Like the ASTM has other public spirited reasons for wanting to create standards, which, by the way, I think is completely true. I mean, these are professional organizations that I think the people, and I've met a lot of people who participate in standards development. And you, as a lawyer, you should think about it as if you contribute your time to the American Bar Association or to the American Law Institute. If someone told you that you were you know, selfish and mean-spirited for doing so. I think you'd look at them like they were crazy. And these activities are kind of the engineering version. So it's certainly true, I think, that there are reasons why these organizations are creating these standards that have to do with the, you know, a public-spirited desire to sort of, you know, help make things safer and work better and to make the profession, you know, responsible. But I also think there's a fundamental question, not just of desire, but of financial ability, right? At the end of the day, you can't do the work unless you have staff and offices and computers and Zoom and all the things that are necessary to produce the standards, to put together those very intensive committee processes. And so that's the part that I think was missing. And that's the part that I often worry about, because I think it's probably true that if tomorrow the copyright revenue disappeared, they'd find another way. The challenge I have is that the other ways are worse ways, ways that imperil the ability of small businesses to participate in the standards development process, to ensure that the standards are not beholden to industry players that can afford to donate a lot of money to the organizations, et cetera, et cetera.
So, well, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, I know you mentioned that UPCOs had a premium version whereby you could pay for a subscription and get commentary and AI help and what have you with the codes. I think it's important to note that the American Society for Testing and Materials had a similar service that, in addition to getting access, they did compliance training to help you understand and stay on the right side of the codes that they themselves developed. And they had a separate revenue stream from that. I would have found it interesting as a former judge and as someone reading this case to have known how much money, for example, the society made off of people paying for just access and the ability to see the standards versus how much money they made off of that compliance training. Were they comparable? Were the compliance training a small part of their revenue in contravention or in comparison to memberships or what have you? There were no official dollar signs anywhere in the judge's opinion as to how much money these organizations made. So we don't know the answer to that, but I would have found that an interesting fact that would have informed my analysis. Zvi, what do you
think? Yeah, so the commerciality analysis strikes me as wrong, to be frank. And I don't think it would surprise a Federalist Society audience to find out that The Nation magazine, so far as I know, never turned a profit. And in 1985, The Nation, well, it actually was years before that, went to the Supreme Court in 85. They reprinted part of Gerald Ford's memoirs where he talked about pardoning Richard Nixon. In advance of a reprint that was scheduled in Time magazine, Harper and Row sued them. The Supreme Court held that this was not a fair use and it was commercial, even though The Nation was structured as a nonprofit. There is longstanding case law that even a nonprofit, if it makes money off of what it's doing, one of the early cases is a nonprofit that plays music at a fundraiser is engaged in commercial activity. So saying that this is non-commercial strikes me as wrong. That's not necessarily fatal to their case. The court has made clear that commercial activity can be fair use, but it's definitely a finger on the scale.
Well, and I also wonder about UPCOs, because they had very good counsel on their side. As both of you have mentioned, this isn't the only litigation in which that company has been involved. You obviously need revenue in order to pay for lawyers. So one would suspect the most likely source of the revenue, the monies that UPCO was using to pay its lawyers, would be people who were paying for the premium version of their product, in order to get the extra features that Professor Brimmer mentioned. So that might also perhaps lend a bit more credence to the thought that there was a commercial value to the publication of these codes themselves, because it led people, it was kind of the bait that led people to come in and at least provide enough revenue where they could hire lawyers who could run an entire report. I'm curious, this is a case that involves a municipality. It's the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And when we think about building a building and the headaches that come with it, it's usually local headaches that we're talking about. But are there cases raising similar issues with federal agencies or acts of Congress whereby they have incorporated by reference some society's private standards? Or has the federal government found a workaround so that when they incorporate standards by reference, the public still has a way to see what those private standards are without cost?
Yeah. Do you want me to speak to that? So the federal government, I mean, there's no like good, simple answer to this. And the, you know, in, I want to say around 2010, the administrative conference did a proceeding in which, you know, I wrote a research report. There was a committee that looked at it. The Assembly of Government and Public Sector members, private sector members came together and approved a recommendation. And basically the solution that we came up with was, okay, agencies, when you are incorporating by reference a copyrighted, actually any copyrighted material, there are other things aside from standards, actually, you should ask the copyright owner how that is available and push them to make it as accessible as possible. Right. And part of that, you know, the AGIS can only make recommendations to government, can't make recommendations to the private sector, but it can encourage agencies to, and they often have relationships with the standards development organizations in their industries, to work with them and to try to encourage them to provide free online access during the rulemaking process for a limited period in order to facilitate public comment. And then after a regulation that incorporates by reference becomes available. The OMB during the Obama administration did a revision of Circular A-119, which is a document that basically implements the Tech Transfer Act, which is a statute that effectively requires agencies to use private standards where possible. And they also sort of backed up that solution. The Federal Register, there are regulations governing how agencies incorporate by reference. They included in part of their process that the agency has to say in the rule how that standard's available, that kind of thing. And the standards development community, it seemed to me, responded pretty well. I mean, not like enthusiastically initially, right? But they rose to the occasion, I think. And, you know, ASTM created an online reading room. ANSI, which is actually not a standards developer, it's a coordinator of the US standards system, created a system so that smaller standards developers that can make their own system for an online reading room were able to make their standards available there. But it's not perfect by any means. And it's not a complete process. There was a brief moment in time where Congress, in a very discreet area involving pipeline safety, tried to just by statute require that the agency could only incorporate by reference things available for free on the internet. And I think the law was repealed within a year because it was unworkable and the agency just found it couldn't achieve its statutory mandate for pipeline safety if it had to comply with that statute. So it's been a long and winding process, I think.
Well, to me, that raises an intellectual property question that I'm going to pose to you. Obviously, the reason why this is an issue is that instead of the city of Philadelphia doing a cut and paste job with the standards from the American Society for Testing and Materials, the 10 that were at issue, and just dropping that into the city code of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is presumably available online or perhaps at City Hall, in the worst case scenario, and you can go down and read it if you want to. They just did and we're adopting this standard, see here, and that's it. Would there have been an intellectual property problem if the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, or for that matter, the federal government said, you know what, we don't want to have to deal with this issue at all. We'll buy a subscription or we have access to it through whatever. And now we're just going to cut and paste and make this binding law for our citizens. And here it is in our normal compendium of code or statute, and anybody can read. Would our friends at the American Society for Testing and Materials have had a case against the city of Philadelphia in such an instance?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of interesting and rather discrete issues, which includes both takings, well, actually mainly takings, but also the 11th Amendment, which is not necessarily a place that you'd expect to be. But so initially, one case we were of is Ruckelshaus House versus Monsanto. I was trying to remember as you were asking, did it involve your agency? I'm not sure. But it involved whether publication of information about regulated pesticides on the internet that were trade secrets constituted a taking. And the Supreme Court said, yes, it could be, but they were accepting a benefit in return, so it wasn't. I don't think there's any benefit in return, though, if you just take them and copy them. So I do think there is a takings problem there. The contours are very undefined. I think the standard setters are understandably leery of bringing such a suit, but it's definitely lurking in the background where it's possible. Now, regarding the federal government, I believe you'd bring suit in a court of federal claims. Regarding a state government, it's actually a lot more complicated because there is no federal jurisdiction for a suit against a state under the 11th Amendment. So you get into a really interesting catch-22, and there was a case, Allen versus Cooper, a couple of years back at the Supreme Court, where the state of North Carolina had engaged in pretty clearly unlawful copying of Mr. Allen's film of a wreck of Queen Anne's Revenge off the coast of North Carolina. And the Supreme Court held that he couldn't sue in state court, and since copyright's exclusively federal, he had no remedy in state court either, effectively. So there is a remedy under takings, but how can we pursue it is actually quite complicated.
Professor Brimmer, any thoughts to add on that hypothetical?
The only thing I'll say is there was an OLC opinion from 1999 about whether or not it would be a fair use for government to use copyrighted material. Fairly close analysis of the fair use arguments, and I published an article on this subject in 2013. I am actually a little surprised at how much traction they've gotten. I mean, the OLC opinion, was not super positive about that. And if you're publishing, the entire thing, then things get more challenging. Now, one question I have, because I think the model code, and by the way, codes are a little different than standards in the sense that codes are developed specifically for the purpose of being made law. So, the Fifth Circuit had this decision like 20 years ago in VEC, where it kind of distinguished those and was more willing to say that a code, once it's adopted, at least qua law, is not copyrighted. The model code retains its copyright protection, but not the code qua law, although how you distinguish, I think, is a challenge. And that's a little different than standards. So with the standards, the agency may not want to publish it for actually other reasons unrelated to copyright. Like, it's just a lot of material in the Federal Register and in the Code of Federal Regulations would be, truly gigantic if all of that stuff was in there. That's one of the reasons why they incorporate by reference.
Well, I want to share an example of, it's not quite incorporation by reference, but here at the Department of Agriculture, believe it or not, our risk management agency, they're the agency that manages crop insurance, which is federally subsidized. Crop insurance, whether it's through risk management agency or through a private company, is, of course, a matter of contract. And for decades, USDA's risk management agency has published all of its contracts in the Code of Federal Regulations so that they can say they are regulations, and they think that gives them, as a result of some court rulings, an extra legal advantage should one of their contracts end up in court. And I have right here the section of 7 CFR, which is basically exclusively contracts. Our risk management agency has put into the Code of Federal Regulations. So there is at least one federal agency, and it also happens to be the federal agency that has the Forest Service. So paper is not a problem here. That we have decided to fill the Code of Regulations with the contracts that we have. So there's a lot of examples for you, Professor. I wanted to pick up on something, a first principle that you laid out in your opening comments, Professor Brimmer, and that is democratic accountability and accessibility of people who are going to be covered by these regulations, which include these private codes and standards. And what would we, forget the copyright issue or what have you, what would we prefer to have? Would we prefer to have the City Council of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the state legislature of a particular state, or the federal legislature, Congress, debate what a proper code would be and enact it into law, because they can ultimately be voted out of office? And though, of course, big business has a lot of influence in any of these bodies, small business has an enormous amount of influence as well. I mean, ask any member of Congress about car dealers and the influence that they may have over certain matters that affect their domain is one prominent example. Or are we not so worried about that? Are we more comfortable with these private standard setting agencies, because being comprised of members who are active in the private economy, it would not behoove them to set a standard that would be uneconomical or impractical, or for other reasons, not able to be carried out. And we can trust them to balance big business versus small business and all the different needs that we have. What do you think about that juxtaposition, Professor Bremer? And then, Svea, I'll give you an opportunity to comment after.
So I think that the optimal, I mean, I'm wary of trusting any of the organizations you just identified implicitly, right? and I think the optimal mix is probably a combination, right? There are some subjects that are matters of social values and addressing social problems that are easily understandable by the public, and that, you know, that the legislature should control and law should be used, and punishment for noncompliance is appropriate. I think, and again, here I would distinguish between codes and standards. I think codes fall more on the law side. Standards fall more on the side of technical specifications that often can remain voluntary, right? I mean, actually, the vast majority of privately developed technical standards are never incorporated by reference, but they are used voluntarily by the industry because they solve problems, engineering problems, technical problems, interoperability problems, where there's no need for law and there's less need for democratic accountability. For me, the thing that is really challenging and interesting about this area is that when you're talking about incorporation by reference, a lot of times what you're talking about is how we sort of join up the public side of ordering and the private side of ordering, right? And what consequences we are willing to accept when those systems are joined. And one thing that worries me, so again, I start from the proposition of if it's law, it should be accessible. It must be accessible. It should be free, right? It should be as easy to look at it as anything in the Federal Register. But for me, the question is, again, how do you get there? How do you get there without breaking something you're not really even looking at, like the standard system, like the ability of agencies to fulfill their statutory mandates, right? And I do worry sometimes that some of the arguments, the public domain arguments for sure, and actually the kind of version of public of fair use that we're seeing now, which seems very, very controlled by a kind of public edicts spirit, which is that anything the government touches sort of becomes public, right? We can't maintain a sovereign private sector if anytime there's any intersection with government, it spreads through the system, right? And actually, this case is a great example, because the thing that was made law is the code, and the code references the standards, which are not directly made law by any government body, but the Midas touch comes through. And they're only looking at secondary references, but the truth is the rabbit hole goes deeper, right? It potentially could reach a very large chunk of these documents.
Any thoughts to add?
Yeah, and I know sort of looking, but I will say, if you look at, let's go back as we should here to the Constitution. It says Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing to authors for a limited time protection of their writings. And so on the one hand, I mean, pretty clearly Congress has spoken, and we've had you know, for quite some time, that, and it's difficult to imagine that simply, like Emily said, the Midas touch. And for instance, at the Copyright Office, they receive quite a bit of material for copyright. The contours of that copyright protection are determined by what they receive, according to Skidmore, the Led Zeppelin case. But pretty clearly, the Copyright Office is not going to do their own version of Napster, and it would be massive copyright infringement for them to do that, to have a giant search engine of, let me hear, see and hear every copyright deposit. And even though they do, there is some force of law to those. On the flip side, and this is quoted very, very heavily in by UpCodes, it's in the report. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts said in 2020, the animating principle of the government edicts doctrine that no one can own the law. And I do think there is a certain unease with saying, well, you know, it's there, but I mean, and, you know, it's doable to get it. I mean, I believe ASTM said an argument, well, if you ask us, then we can give you access. And I do think that seems kind of uneasy. And I think we're really in a really interesting sort of twilight area of copyright and policy here.
Well, we've got about 13 minutes left, and we've got some questions that have come in. And I want to encourage our listeners that if they have questions and they haven't put them in the question and answer box, to please do so, because we're moving to that now. I want to pose, first of all, perhaps a solution that one of our viewers has submitted, and he is, talk about rare, positing California as a positive example for how to handle this. He cites to the California Code of Regulations, and they have a specific requirement that applies if an agency wishes to incorporate by reference another standard in that agency's regulations. And the California Code of Regulations, it's 1 CCR section 20C2, according to our erudite viewer, says the following. The agency demonstrates in the final statement of reasons that the document was made available upon request directly from the agency or was reasonably available to the affected public from a commonly known or specified source. In cases where the document was not available from a commonly known source and could not be obtained from the agency, the regulation shall specify how a copy of the document may be obtained. What do you think about that solution that California has come up with? Either it needs to be reasonably available to the public, or the agency needs to tell the public in the regulation where it can go to get a copy.
So that is basically federal law. Federal law says it has to be reasonably available to the class of persons affected thereby. A copy is put public inspection at the agency and at the Federal Register. And then, as I mentioned before, OFR has changed its regulations to require the agency to explain, to address the question of reasonable availability, to make a finding of reasonable availability, and then to provide information about where the document can be obtained. The challenge, I think, is just our expectations are I can go on my computer and pull it up now for free. And what I just described to you and what I read and what I understand from the California provision, which I think is consistent with the federal approach, is just it doesn't get you there.
Zvi, any thoughts?
I was afraid I'd have to say California is smart, but I'm glad that Professor Bremer has just abused us of that notion of FAA special intelligence.
Well, let's go to our next question.
Can I actually add one little thing?
Sure, absolutely.
So as I mentioned, you know, the SDOs have been providing more free access as a result of the government really pushing them to. In the DC Circuit case, this was used kind of against the SDOs as kind of like, well, you make it available for free, so how much can you really care? And I think it was a lost opportunity because, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be a transformative use if the SDO themselves are already providing free access for those who wish to read the law. And so it would have been, I think it was an opportunity wasted to say, like, your copyright retains fully intact if you are already ensuring that people who want to see it can see it for free online. And that would have been, I think, a way to use copyright as an incentive to sort of shore up the federal government's solution to this problem. But
well, I mean, that's pretty much what the Pro Codes Act is trying to do in some part. And it is. And it reminds me a little bit, this is going to be a deep cut. I don't know if you remember the whole thing with colorization, taking black and white movies, making them color. The Copyright Office and U.S. government worked with the studios to say, hey, you can get a copyright for your colorized movies, but only if you give a pristine black and white copy to the Library of Congress. And it's a way to sort of try to advance the public while giving copyright protection in a way that really tries to, and it ended up working really well. Transformative use, I think it made sense in the Campbell case. It's being, and I will say the Supreme Court really said this in the Warhol case, which is why I thought the district court opinion here, and I think also the DC Circuit's opinion in Public Resource, it kind of relied on a very broad reading of transformation that I do think the Supreme Court pretty much rejected in Warhol, saying, no, transformation is a doctrine which cannot be used to say, you know, basically abracadabra transformation. You can't just invoke it and say it's, you know, different. And I have a really hard time as well with a transformation argument. I think that it's definitely the Pro Codes Act would potentially be productive. I don't know what's going on with it in this Congress or not. I know it did okay. It got to the floor of the last Congress in the House, but that's the last. But so far, that's all it's done.
Zvi, for our audience who isn't as dug in as you are, what in general is the Pro Codes Act? What would this proposed piece of legislation do?
Yeah, it's basically proposed legislation that does exactly what Professor Bremer is saying, which is it makes very clear that you retain copyright in your code. You have to make it available in an online portal, and that portal is just for viewing, no downloading, nothing like that. If you want to be able to really play with it, you have to pay for it. But it's freely available if you just want to double check it to make sure of the language. And so that's, yeah.
All right. Well, one of the things that I always love when I was in the courtroom was when the parties themselves in a business case cared enough to show it. That always told me that there was some passion behind it. And it usually also meant that maybe I get some facts I wouldn't otherwise have access to. And it just so turns out that one of the litigants in this case has decided to tune in today. And they have also decided to come out and ask a question. So I want to give them an opportunity to do so. One of the founders of UpCodes, Mr. Garrett Reynolds, has apparently tuned in, and he submitted the following thoughts that perhaps I could have you react to. He's been watching us, and he's noted that one of the things that we've talked about is the pecuniary interests on both sides of the equation. So I guess he heard me ask what the dollar figures were, and he wants to put his thoughts in there. And here's what he has to say. In terms of the publisher's claims, and in this case, that will be the American Society for Testing and Materials, that they'll go out of business if the law is just given away for free in an unfettered form. Has there ever been any evidence for that? There's evidence to the contrary that I wish to share, but I'm wondering where their fears have any evidentiary support. We, meaning UpCodes, and public interest groups have been posting free access to ICC-associated laws for 10 years now. And yet, their revenue has increased every single year, recently breaking through $100 million. And he cites a ProPublica, itself a nonprofit organization, news organization website with a link to support his revenue. And he says, ASTM, the American Society for Testing and Materials, the plaintiff in this case, is increasing over time too, despite publicresource.org posting ASTM's codes adopted into law also for 10 plus years. And he once again cites to the ProPublica website and their own revenue forms there. So we have the UpCodes founder telling us that despite what ASTM would have everyone believe is his essentially stealing from them, that these organizations, these code-setting organizations, including the American Society for Testing Materials, somehow seem to continue to increase in revenue. Does that change how you think about the case, Zvi?
No, not too much. I mean, it's, and the honest truth is, I mean, it feels like it's addressed to the wrong place, both here and, I mean, when I say, honestly, we love to have it here. I don't know if he's right or wrong. I'm a copyright lawyer. I don't think the copyright lawyer bends quite the way that UpCode has been arguing, whether they're right on a policy level. I think that a better way to approach this would be to approach this approach the legislature and you know, perhaps have a discussion with the people who are behind the technical measures about legislative solution. And listen, maybe they'll win. I mean, I don't think it's a secret that certain litigation is policy by other means. And, you know, this has been going on in copyright for 150 years, that you have an attempt to push for boundaries of copyright in various ways. But it's a bit of a straw man to say they say we're going to go under if we take their IP, but look, we're doing fine. I mean, that's not how it works in IP, because everyone, I mean, every alleged infringer says something like that. But on the flip side, I do think, I mean, let me be clear. I do think, as I said before, there's some force to the argument that these should be made available. And I think that Congress has tried to wrestle with that. And I do wonder if one reason why it hasn't wrestled harder is because perhaps some people think they can win the courts. And if they can't win the courts, then maybe everyone has to go to Congress, especially if they have a decision no one likes, which is marvelous for getting Congress's attention.
I'll just add that I don't have data, right? I studied this for many years, and I talked to a lot of people on both sides of the question, but at the end of the day, I can't look at their books. And that's not the thing that, you know, exclusively forms my views. I agree with Professor Rosen that there's a question of what the law is, and then there's the question of the policy, and then there's the question of the economics behind it. And those are separable, but have to be considered sort of all together. And I know Public Resource has been posting them for a long time, not everything and not in as much of a system. I mean, I've made the argument to the SDOs, you can do this, you can provide free access, you know, in a read-only format and still maintain your business model. And they are becoming receptive to that. I mean, the National Fire Protection Association, which frankly was the model for this solution, has been doing that. Gosh, it had been 10 years when I started working on this, so it must be close to 25 now. So it is totally doable. There are other questions too that I think are important, which is, you know, what does this do to incentives for using older standards as opposed to updated standards? What does this do to ensuring that the standards are the correct copies? Right. There are lots of other questions, I think, that are sort of aside from just the money questions.
And we happen to have had the other side chime in recently. One of the other code-setting agencies, the ICC, not the one at issue in the specific case we've been talking about, points out that it's important for a court to consider the effects on the market if the conduct of the, I'll say, alleged infringer, as this is still up in the air, were to become more widespread. So I love it that we've got both sides watching us today and jousting. But I want to end with the opportunity for one more person to ask a question. And this will kind of bring in tort law. One of the items that Judge Brody posited in her opinion was she found that it was necessary for UpCodes or someone else in UpCodes' position to copy the exact standard because that is what people will be held to in the law, and anything else would not be as good and would not be serving the purpose and would not be helpful in terms of a publication. And we have a questioner that wants to know, well, where would liability lie if there are misrepresentations or errors that were published by third parties like UPCodes that perhaps an unsuspecting person visiting a website might find themselves on the wrong side of the law because of an error or misrepresentation? And might that change if these standard setting organizations lose their copyright?
That's a fascinating question. I'm not a torts expert. I mean, I honestly, do know a little bit about it. But I will point out that a lot of these codes are actually, and this is pointed out by UPCodes, are not the current code anyway. So we're actually using out. I don't know if these are outdated or more that the. They're using older ones because they don't like the newer ones. But it's definitely an aspect of different codes being in effect in different places in terms of different revisions. And I don't know how that would play into that as well.
Professor Brimmer, any thoughts?
Alas, I'm also not a torts expert, but I think it's a fascinating question. I mean, I think ordinarily mistake of law is not a defense to, right? I don't know. That's a thing I heard in law school, but that's all I've got.
Well, we thankfully reached our time, perhaps for the torts practitioners out there. But this was a wonderful discussion. I love it that we had actual participants in the litigation sort of join us and poke both sides with questions. So, Sarah, I'm going to turn it over back to you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor Brimmer and Professor Rosen for speaking with us today and to Judge Baden for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, bedsot.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.